Did you know that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day? Hi, Zach Kuhn here, entrepreneur, Nashville music business professional, and I'm here to tell you that if you need to recruit people for your business, ZipRecruiter is the place to do it. But don't take my word for it. You should take my word for it. And here's what you need to do. You need to go to ZipRecruiter.com/Zach. That's www.ziprecruiter.com/Zach to learn more there about recruiting the best people for your business. The fastest, best people fast. You know that fast, good, cheap pyramid? Well, this is doing it all. This is fast, good, and yeah, you got to check out the pricing online. That's kind of above my pay grade, but ZipRecruiter, check it out. Too many ads. Here we go. From Nashville Briefing and the American Songwriter Podcast Network, this is the Zach Kuhn Show, episode 59. Holy crap, we are cruising through these episodes. My guest today is Kurt Deutsch. He is the founder and president of Shookaboom and Ghost Light Records. He is also the SVP of Theater and Catalog at Warner Chappell. Okay, there's a lot going on here, but don't worry, we're going to walk you through all of it. What I love about Kurt is that Kurt is someone who really pioneered a space that he went into. 20 years ago, let's say, when Kurt was starting out, theatrical producers did not share in the rights of their master recordings in the way they do today. You know, Kurt saw how important of an asset the cast recording was, and he knew that producers had to share in these rights. And he's really pioneered this space and changed the way people think about cast albums. And he continues to lead this industry today. And we're talking about an industry where there's a handful of people really leading it at the forefront. I mean, maybe 2 or 3 others. It's unbelievable. And the catalog speaks for itself. We're talking about some of the biggest shows over the past 20 years. We're talking about the last 5 years. We're talking about Book of Mormon. We're talking about In the Heights. We're talking about Beetlejuice. We're talking about 13. Yes, with Ariana Grande. We talked about it all. Okay, look, I don't want to give anything away. If you're a music person, if you're a theater person, if you just love great entrepreneur stories, this is your episode. Here we go. Episode 59, Kurt Deutsch. Let's dive in.
Every time I have a label founder on my show, like Craig, or I had John Cohen on, the founder of Vagrant, and they always talk about how their first projects were always something that had a built-in audience. Like Craig's first projects were these compilation albums, and John Cohen, his first project was he had known artists record covers, and he created compilations that way. So there was a built-in audience that would buy the project. Shookaboom's first project was kind of Broadway stars recording solo albums. So they would be on stage promoting and they maybe had names themselves. Was that the thought process or was that the strategy early on? These projects built in?
Yeah, Shookaboom initially was started by my former wife, Sherry Renee Scott, and myself. And Sherry was starring in Aida at the time with Adam Pascal. And she had done Tommy with Alice Ripley. And I was an actor at the time. We had moved back to New York. This was 1998-99. We got married in 1998. And we were both acting at the time, and I met her doing Randy Newman's musical Faust. And when Aida started, somebody approached her about doing kind of a show tune record. And it was at that time, back in 1999, 2000, where Amazon was just kind of starting, and I looked at the recording contract and it was ridiculous, and just the royalty structure and how, and Sherry didn't really have a desire to do a show tune record. And there was this whole new generation of Broadway stars who were writing their own stuff or had a desire to do something more performative, or, you know, there's a gospel choir, but the idea was, and it really stemmed after Rent. because I think Rent really was the key to kind of the new generation of Broadway. And so had this idea. I read this book by Don Passman, you know, which everybody reads. It's the Bible, you know, he's like everything you want to know about the music business. And said, well, let's just start a record label for the Broadway community, and we'll do these solo records. And the idea was that we would bridge the gap between rock and roll and theater. So that was kind of the idea when we started it. And it was, we put out Sherry's record, which was called Men I've Had. And it was covers by all of the composers that she had worked with on Broadway. So it was Elton John and Pete Townsend and Randy Newman and maybe there was a Candor Nebb song, and then Adam Pascal was all original music, and Adam was in the original cast of Rent. He was the original Roger in Rent. And Alice Ripley's album was all original songs that she had written. It was called Everything's Fine. And we did a gospel album called Great Joy, which was for the Broadway Inspirational Voices. So those were the first records that I did. And the idea was that there was a built-in audience for these people because they were performing on stage for 15,000 people a week.
Right.
And I don't think anybody at the time had done this before, but we put their website, their personal websites, in their bios in the playbill. If they were interested, they would come online and we would build these websites for them. And if they were interested in them, they could buy their album or their CD. And then we got lucky because Disney, who produced Aida, was very generous and supportive of our project. And they allowed the solo CDs to be sold in the theaters. So I think it was the first time kind of their solo CDs were allowed to be in the theaters.
How
at
did
the
you
time.
Figure out the split with them? Like what, like were they taking, did they take a merch percentage or like, cause you would think that that would take away from sales from their own licensed music. Or
you know, I think that actually, to be honest with you, I believe at the time that any money they made off of Sherry and Adam's CDs were donated to Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. So if I remember correctly, they donated whatever percentage that they made to charity.
Wow. Which,
it's very cool. So that's how it all started. And we kind of built the label around this new generation of new generation of Broadway artists. And at the time I was working out of my second bedroom and we formed an alliance with The Cutting Room. I don't know if you remember The Cutting Room, but we did, yeah. It was a bar, and we would do these midnight concerts every Thursday night called the Shikaboom Room. And so it was a place where, at that time, the Broadway community, and the reason we did it on Thursday nights was because it was kind of the night that the Broadway stars would go out late a lot of times because they didn't have a matinee the next day. It wasn't their day off, you know, so they would go out on Thursday nights. We would do a midnight show, and it was like fans of the Broadway artists and the Broadway artists, and everybody would come together, and we did concerts. I remember we did, you know, I mean, obviously there was Sherry and Adam and Alice, but Idina Menzel did a concert. I remember it was a double bill between Idina Menzel and Gavin DeGraw and lots of people. And then we did holiday concerts, and it was just kind of building the brand of what Shikaboom was. And it was, and we did reading. We did, I think, the first reading of, what eventually became Next to Normal, and Norbert Leo Butz was in it with Sherry and Greg Naughton, and there's some bootleg somewhere out there where you can hear that concert, and people were like, who's going to go see a musical about electric shock therapy? And then it wins the Pulitzer Prize later on, you know? And so it's it was fun. It was fun. And it was really before, I mean, we're talking, you know, 21 years ago. So, you know, it was before all of the, I mean, now there's many, many, you know, there's Monday night cast part. There's a lot of cabaret like things that are that, but this was kind of the beginning. And some of the big, I remember, you know, when 9/11 happened, we did a big 9/11 benefit at the Village Theater, and Mario Cantone hosted it, and it just grew and grew and grew, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to build it. So, but that was, you know, I that was solo albums bridging the gap between rock and roll and theater. It wasn't necessarily cast albums and the cast albums of Broadway shows, and that happened a little bit later on.
Wait, so I want to get to that in a second, but so this is kind of like around the cusp of like the Napster era, give or take maybe like a year or two off. Are you thinking, because now I think like I'm always doing the math in my head, okay, if I were to start a label, I would need to get this many streams to make this tiny bit of money, split with, like it's a nightmare to think about how you would start a label today and how many streams you would need. Of course, you were starting a business. I'm sure there was some business plan, but were you marking out like, okay, we need to sell this many CDs to break even? Like, what's it going to take? Like, were you doing that math, or were you just kind of like, let's just put it out and see what happens? Like, who knows what's going to happen with this first or second release?
Yeah. At the beginning, it was a learn. I mean, it was all, I mean, I knew nothing about the music industry. I mean, I was an actor. I also didn't, you know, in my mind, Broadway was a much bigger deal. And like, of course, everybody knows who Adam Pascal is from Rent. And of course, people will know. And so we're going to sell so many records and do all this stuff. But in reality, that wasn't the case. And you know, in Broadway is really this kind of 8-block Times Square, very specialized place, and not a lot of people around the world are connected in the same way that they're connected now. So yeah, it was very different. And I think that I had much bigger expectations of sales than I anticipated. I spent way too much money at the time on these records. And that really led to, you know, it's not that I didn't want to do the solo records as much as it was really tweaking a business model, and wanting to be more in the cast album world, where I thought that, you know, I grew up with cast albums, and it just was an eventual evolution. I still did solo records, but they were not as, it's, you know, I'm not a major label. So the idea of breaking an artist, and also these guys are doing 8 shows a week. They're not touring the same way.
Right.
So
late night shows as frequently, or they can't do press in the same way. It's challenging.
Yeah.
So did you figure out distribution with Razor and Tie early on? Is that who
No. So at the beginning, I had no distribution. We were selling the CD. I mean, we had like Amazon, you know, Alliance or something like that, where
it's just with like a CD company printer, essentially. Like
at the beginning, I found a CD manufacturing company, and I rented a U-Haul and picked them up and put them in my second bedroom shower. And then if orders came in from my website, I would just pack them up
and ship them out.
And then I got, after a little bit, I got that my first distribution company was a company called Image Entertainment. They were mostly known as a DVD distribution company, but they took me on, and I was with them for a couple of years before I met Razor and Ty and Craig and Cliff, and I think I did my first cast album, which was in the last 5 years, right. And Image distributed that, but But that actually was the turning point of when I really started focusing much more on cast albums.
What did, like, when you teamed up with Razor and Tie or with Image Entertainment, like, were they getting you in like the Virgin Mega stores at the time? Or like, is that what you were expecting from a distributor at the time? Just placement in stores?
Yeah, it was really placement in stores and basically that was hopefully the idea. It was because the DTC, the direct to consumer, was harder. And it's that, you know, when somebody goes and sees a show, you think that they're falling in love with the actor, but they're actually falling in love with the character. And so there was that, you know, you need to make that leap of faith that they're going to say, oh, I want to know more about this person and this artist.
Right.
And so there's kind of a little bit of a disconnect. You know, I think with Adam, we sold more of Adam's albums because he had much more of a, you know, because Rent was so incredibly popular that he had a built-in audience. He was able to go out there and tour in colleges and do more things. And Sherry was really focused on her own artistry and doing 8 shows a week, and that took a lot out of her. So so she wasn't really able to tour in the same way that Adam was. Alice was out there touring, and then the choir was out there touring. But it was great fun, and it was the beginning of something, and you know, and we're still around 20 years later. So.
Absolutely. Okay, wait. So Sherry was in the last 5 years, but was that the natural segue to record the album, or how did that, so she was in it. So how involved were you in those recording sessions? Like, were you in the studio that day doing it?
Yeah. So the last 5 years happened. I think March of 2002. I believe, when was 9/11 was 2001.
2001, yeah.
Yeah. So it opened March of 2002 and off Broadway. And it was in the Village at the Minetta Lane Theater in the Village. And at that time, New York City after 9/11 was really a ghost town. And the show was, the show got mixed reviews. And I talked to the producers of the show and I said, you know, I have this record label. And it was the same.
How many releases have you done at that point? Like was the label profitable when at that point, like how
profitable? Long did- No, it was just, I have this label, but I had a model. You know, I had a business model, and I said, basically at that time I'd learned more. Right. So I basically said to the producers, because the album contract that they had originally gave Sherry for her solo record is a very similar contract to what they give to Broadway shows. And the royalty structure is such that yes, the record label pays for the album. However, it has to sell so many units
right.
in order for it to actually make a profit. And I couldn't believe at the time when I learned that the producers of the shows would potentially give away one of their biggest assets. And so at that time, it was Ariel Tepper and Marty Bell were the producers of the last 5 years. And I said to them, hey, this album's going to cost 90 grand or 100. I don't remember how much it cost. Why don't we just invest in this together? We'll co-own the master. I have distribution now, and we'll get it out there. And they were like, okay, you know, and I mean, I think that it was a leap of faith for them. It was a leap of faith for Jason Robert Brown, I think, and all of the actors. But But we did it. And Jeffrey Lesser was the album producer. I was more of a, I mean, I was, you know, I slept in the studio. I was there for the entire mix. I was there for, I mean, it was, you know, it's my baby. It was my first cast album. So
did Jason R. Brown, he played the piano on that recording, right? If I'm not mistaken,
I believe so. I believe he did. I believe
is
he
that,
did.
Is that like, there's a story of like Michael Grieve telling Jonathan Larson that he had to exit the rehearsals because his presence in the room was so stressful for the actors on stage doing the material. As everyone's recording with him in the room playing the piano, does that create like a stressful environment to be singing in front of him, or is he pretty laid back? It's pretty easy.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say Jason is laid back, but he's everybody was at the top of their craft at the time. You know what I mean? Yeah. Norbert and Sherry, Daisy Prince, who was the director, it was a two-person musical, right, sung through. It was very, I mean, the whole thing, we did it in a day, and it was just a glorious day. I mean, I remember Norbert was in one isolation booth, Sherry was in another isolation booth, the orchestra, we were all breathing together, doing it all together. And it was magic, you know, it was magic.
Does the record?
No, you know, go ahead.
Does the record ever not get done in a day? To me, that is insane. Does it always get done the day? Do you ever go back in for overdubs, or it always gets done in that one day?
I think since technology has changed over time, you know, I think Adam and Sherry's albums were done to tape, you know. You know, so I don't, you know, this, I think that we did do the last 5 years on Pro Tools, but we were at Avatar. We were in Avatar Studio C, so it was our power station or whatever it was named at the time. But
that's what the Berkeley hub.
Now it's Berkeley. Now it's the Berkeley power station, I think. Technology has changed in that we can track easily or easy. There's been a few things that have happened. Recording, you know, big recording studios have kind of gone away.
Right.
You know, the big recording studios with lots of isolation, and you know, where you had the Hit Factory and you had Right Track, which was a big studio. And so those big giant recording studios have kind of gone away. And
right? Like, is there any other major studio of that size in New York?
Well, there's the Demena Center in New York City that has big rehearsal rooms that they can kind of isolate. And now you can wire. So you're maybe the orchestra is in one studio and the cast is in a different studio and the chorus is in a different studio. So you're like, you have three studios going at one time and you're wired together. But a lot of times what you'll do now is you'll track the orchestra first, and then you'll lay the vocals on top of it. And a lot of composers like that because you can, you can focus much more on the music, and then you can focus much more on the performances. Sometimes you'll overlap with maybe one session when there's music that needs to be led by the actor, you know, it's out of time or it's rubato or, you know, whatever. So you really need the give and take of the actor and the musician at the same time to be able to do that. And, you know, sometimes we'll do shows like Kiss Me, Kate, or She Loves Me, you know, these big revivals, even Bridges of Madison County, where we're all in the room together. We take our headphones off and we just do it old school and just like make a record, you know, where you start at 10 o'clock in the morning and you're done at 5 and you've got this album, because it's like you don't, there's no synthesizers. It's just an orchestra, vocals, chorus, and you just like do it.
Oh, great.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it's like, it's all about flexibility. It's all about what you want an album to sound like. And, you know, and the much, you know, more rock, you know, every show is different. And, you know, a show like In the Heights was done very different from, you know, Hair to, it's, I mean, I've done like 200 cast albums by now. So it's like, everything is different. And you just look at each musical and you figure out what it needs. And you figure out, because you have so little time in the studio, you want to make sure that you have as much control and isolation as possible, because everything happens in the mix. And yes, you can bring an actor in to overdub something if, you know, it just isn't right, and, you know, or you want them to retake something or whatever.
Are there any mistakes in cast albums that you've done that you like missed in the moment, and then you go back and you go, holy crap, I can't believe we left that in our 24-hour rush to record?
We left it in, or we forgot to actually record it.
Or I guess
or you didn't hear, or you don't hear, you know, the trumpet is playing a horrible, you know, note, or it's like completely off key, or, you know, like those kinds of things. But yeah, there's been, I mean, you know, you miss stuff sometimes, but I mean, you schedule it so meticulously. And you try to, you know, everybody is on different microphones. You know, you number the microphones. You have to move things. It's like playing a traffic cop, and you're really figuring out where everybody is at the time and thing. And you just go through it. It's kind of like, I liken it when I was an actor. I was on a lot of really bad television shows, and being on TV and being in TV series is kind of like summer stock for features. You know what I mean? Like it's like, cause it happens so fast and you're going through 8 pages in a day. Whereas in a feature film, maybe you'll do 2 pages in a day or something like that. And with a cast album, you know, you have to do the entire album in a day, which seems insane when like a band will go in and take so much time on one song or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, the reason that we can do them in a day is that these actors and these musicians are playing the show 8 times a week. And so it's like they're athletes, and it's like a muscle memory in them, and they have the performance in them, and it's about capturing the energy and the musicianship and the artistry, you know, on not tape, but in a sonic and aural environment. So it that's why you can do them in a day.
Right. Do you pitch, like, I work for a label in Nashville and I'm their head of sales and DSP relationships. So I'm always on with the DSPs. I'm always pitching. Does that kind of, I know there are Broadway playlists on Spotify. I'm sure it's advantageous to be on them, but do you focus a lot on that? Or is there someone on the team that's always pitching to DSPs and trying to get on those playlists?
Yeah, we have, well now, so my company is part of Arts Music at Warner Music Group. And we have someone who is in constantly talking to Amazon and Spotify and you know, for the Amazon, you know, Broadway thing, and iHeart Broadway has things, and, you know, and we create a lot of playlists ourselves, just through our own label. We create, you know, whether it's Women's Month or Black History Month or a holiday playlist. We have tons of playlists that we've created. So we're always looking for ways to find the community that loves Broadway that is there too. And it's an interesting community because you've got the young Broadway fans who love shows like Be More Chill and In the Heights and Legally Blonde and Heathers and, you know, these more younger Beetlejuice. And then you've got an older audience, which might not be a streaming audience, might be more they might be more of a physical audience, you know, for shows like Kiss Me Kate or She Loves Me, or, you know, just the more traditional Broadway musicals. Right. And so you cater to the different communities, and you try to build around who that what that niche is, but it's a very specific niche. That's getting larger and larger and more global as time goes on.
Right, right. What percentage of sales, if you can share, are streaming versus physical? Like, is physical still a big part of your business?
This year?
Maybe not this year, but maybe in general.
It's interesting because I would say streaming right now is, upwards of 80 to 90% of my business. Pre-pandemic, it was less. Because we were selling in the theater, and there's no theater right now. But also you have shows that are more geared towards physical sales, like Tina, the musical, where, you know, people want that CD, because it's an older audience. We saw a lot of physical sales of Beautiful, the musical, because it was a older skewing audience. So it's really about the demographic, I think, than anything else.
Right. Absolutely. So how did you end up working on American Utopia? How did you get involved with that? I know David Byrne is with Warner Chappell. Was it an easy segue, or what did that look like taking it from the road into a Broadway theater?
So David is, first of all, a genius and like one of my heroes in life. And to get to work on that in a small way was really exciting. So I went and saw the show in Brooklyn at the King's Theater when it was in New York. And he's also on Nonesuch Records, which is the album came out on Nonesuch, which is a Warner, in the Warner family. So David Byther, who runs Nonesuch, we sat at the King's Theater, and there was just talk that David maybe wanted to do this on Broadway. And so since I'm kind of the theater guy at Warner Music Group, they said, is this something that we can do? And at that time, I met him, and I actually talked to a ad agency to kind of come up with some artwork. I had a meeting with him, and he was meeting with a bunch of different Broadway producer types. And my friend Kristen Caskey and Patrick Cotullo ended up, who have a lot of experience producing on Broadway. And Kristen works for Ambassador Theater Group, which is the owner of the Hudson Theater. And they really took the lead in producing the Broadway show. And Warner Music Group were co-producers of that. And then when there was an opportunity to film it, and Spike Lee came on board to direct it, we were very supportive of the project, and it was amazing to, you know, to be able to do that. And it was right before the lockdown, you know, so to get it in the can right before the pandemic hit, and then to be able to release it, you know, right before the election, I think that, and kind of what it says just philosophically about community and voting and racial inequality, and the message behind it, it was very powerful and remains very powerful. And I think that, you know, when I was a freshman in college, I believe Stop Making Sense came out, And so to be able to have Stop Making Sense and now American Utopia, these beautiful bookends,
right,
to a career that, I mean, I think that, it, you know, he's got so many projects, and, but just to see these two projects as kind of like these, you know, the Jonathan Demme, and then you got the Spike Lee, and then you've got these collaborations, and it has been an amazing thing to be part of.
Was it, I only saw it on Broadway. I never saw the tour. Did it change a lot when it went to Broadway, or like, how did you have to figure out how to make it work in a Broadway theater with a Broadway audience, or did he pretty much take the show, put it in?
So no, there was a lot of thought. So, so David, has had a collaboration with Alex Timbers, who directed Here Lies Love and another production that was at the Public. And I think David and Alex really sat down and looked at the tour, because what David always would say was like, I like to get the audience up by the third song, so they're dancing by the third song. And on Broadway, it's more of a slow burn. You know what I mean? So it's they don't necessarily have to get up so fast. So you looked at the order of the songs, and then also what he was, there was more narration, more talking than there was when he was touring. It wasn't necessarily kind of, I mean, it always started with the brain and the and that and kind of and the chains coming down and all of that kind of stuff.
Or going up, maybe.
I think that the chains were
going up.
And then they came down. But I think the order of the songs changed. There may have been songs omitted or added, and just a little bit more of a through line and a journey that was more theatrical. I mean, I wouldn't call it a musical by any stretch of the imagination. I would call it a musical experience or a musical journey. But it was a celebration. I mean, I think it was ultimately a celebration of community and, yeah.
Holy cow. Such a cool show. I think it was like the last time I was in a Broadway theater, if I remember correctly.
There you go.
Was seeing that show. It was amazing.
Hey, I was supposed to go to the opening night of Six on March 12th and it got canceled. So yeah, it's, my last show was, a show called The Unknown Soldier. And it was by Michael Friedman, who passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it was a Playwrights Horizons, and it was the opening night of that. And it was very moving because Michael's no longer around. And I worked with Michael, you know, extensively over the years.
Holy cow! Well, yeah. We're excited to get back. So jumping a little bit. Did anybody know when you were working on 13, the musical, and producing and working on that cast album, did anyone have any idea that Ariana Grande was going to become as big a star as she did? Did you have a sense?
Who?
Of Ariana Grande?
Who? Who's she? That whole cast was, you know, were stars. I mean, that, you know, you look at that cast and, you know, they all ended up being, but Ariana, I mean, I remember Jason, I mean, you know, I think we did one video with her and she, it was the, I forgot the name of the song, but yeah. And she did this riff and it was just like incredible. And everybody's like, who is this girl? You know, who knows how things happen, but she was amazing, you know, at 13 or 14 or however old she was. There's all of these kids that came from Florida, I think. And they were all kind of best friends and they were in the show, and there was a performing arts school in Florida and they were in it. Now 13's being made into a Netflix movie. And it's Jason Robert Brown is in Toronto right now, rehearsing for the 13, the musical, the movie.
Holy cow. So she didn't stand out above everyone. The whole cast was talented. Like, you could have picked anyone. She was just a member of the cast. Who, I mean,
she was actually in the chorus.
She was in the chorus. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. She wasn't, I mean, but she was amazing. At that time, you know, you don't think, oh my gosh, Ariana Grande is going to be Grande. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, whoever knows, you know, who knew that I was going to have a record label, you know, it's like, you never know where your life will take you. And, you know, and she was on a track to, you know, she did her, I guess she was on one of those Disney Channel shows. And, and then from there ended up, you know, starting singing and then ended up, you know, becoming giant pop star.
Met Scooter Braun and the rest is history. So when did you team up with Warner Chappell, or when did you start working with them? What does that relationship look like versus what you do with Shikaboom?
So, I guess it was about 4 years ago. I entered into a venture with Warner Music Group for my label. And that's when Arts Music was created. And Arts Music is really the umbrella for my record label, Warner Classics. There's a children's division, part of Warner. And that's where I worked there. But at the same time, there was an opportunity. I remember I got a call from Bob Hurwitz, who runs Nonesuch, and there was an opportunity for me to take over and look after the theater writers at Warner Chappell. And John Platt at the time was head of Warner Chappell, and I was talking to him and I said, you know, what I really want to do is produce shows and in develop shows. And we have, you know, you have, there's a million songs here. There's incredible catalogs and legacies. And I think that there's an opportunity to develop a lot and to invest in some shows and work with our writers to develop. And so, it was kind of a natural fit, you know, where I can record the cast albums or one of our sister labels, whether it's Atlantic or Warner Records or Nonesuch, would record them. And then at Warner Chappell, I can kind of oversee theatrical opportunities, but also look after our theater writers and more theater catalogs like Cole Porter and Gershwin and Lerner and Lowe, and, you know, the list goes on and on, and like that. And then take care of signing some of the more up and coming theater writers, and also our amazing theater writers like Alan Menken and Stephen Schwartz and Lin-Manuel Miranda and Joe Iconis, Eddie Perfect, Shania Taub. You know, it's great. I've never worked for anybody before. I was always on my own, and you know, and I am very grateful that I feel part of a really great community at Warner. It's been a good 4 years, and I'm happy there.
Is your work with Ghostlight and Shikaboom and the Warner Chappell, is that kind of like segmented, or does it all just kind of flow together and like everything you do is basically building on both things?
No, it's separate. It is separate, but there is overlap. Like, for example, Beetlejuice, you know, I was able we were able to sign Eddie Perfect to Warner Chappell not necessarily as a byproduct, but I thought Beetlejuice would be a great album, you know, in a similar way that Be More Chill. I thought it would be kind of a sticky record, you know, viral record. And so I was fortunate enough to to be able to put it on Ghostlight as well. And so it doesn't always happen. But, and a lot of the stuff that I have been developing with Warner Chappell doesn't necessarily cross over to Ghostlight, but there's, it's a company that I don't like to think in silos really at all. And I think that having, you know, there be, you know, like I talked to folks from Atlantic and Nonesuch and Warner Records and everybody, because I try to bring everybody together, you know, and especially as theater is so collaborative and is such a collaborative art form that it's just in my DNA to build teams and to want to have as much, you know, you want the best for everybody. And if it's not on Ghostlight, that's okay. It's like, I just want to make good shit, you know, stuff.
Shit, whatever. Say anything you want.
Yeah.
So, okay,
wait. I want to make good stuff.
So before I let you run, because I know how busy you are, would you get involved with a TikTok musical, the Bridgerton musical, the Ratatouille musical? Would you get involved in one of those? There's a big audience, it feels like, baked into those.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I think that it's fascinating. I think that there probably are rights issues with all of those things. You know, and I feel like the zeitgeist kind of, you know, we're living in this world where everything is moving so fast. What I do think though about these musicals, regardless of whether Bridgerton or Ratatouille or any of these other musicals are coming up, is that it's an amazing showcase for these writers.
Right.
So Emily Bear and Danny Mertzloft and Abigail Barlow, I think, have been able to get signed by great agents and managers and have been able to set themselves apart so that, you know, people will be saying, hey, that's that person, that's that artist who created the Bridgerton musical. Even if the Bridgerton musical doesn't necessarily, you know, happen, they made something, and they made something from a community. And you know, so I think that it's a great way to, you know, market yourself. I mean, just like YouTube is a great way to get your stuff out there and to get your stuff
known on YouTube.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, and finding, and Joe Iconis, the same thing. I mean, like, we recorded Be More Chill in New Jersey at a New Jersey production, and we recorded it. And a year and a half later, you know, or not a year and a half, maybe a year, year and a half later, we just started seeing all these YouTube videos from fan art and stuff like that. And then it just kind of took off, and you just never know how things are going to happen. But I think TikTok is a platform that allows for people to find an audience, and people who are interested in theater to and musical theater to, you know, find their community. It's all about community building.
Right. Absolutely.
Clubhouse, okay. You know, Clubhouse, same thing.
I want the Clubhouse musical. Where's the Clubhouse musical?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, you can't see, I mean, you can hear it, but you can't necessarily see it. So but that's more like I don't know. I mean, I think they did do Hamilton and Lion King on Clubhouse for some, they did do that, but I, you know.
So the creators are going to hang around, the musicals may or may not on TikTok, who knows, TBD, to be determined. What's the, in your mind, just for you, what is the perfect cast recording? Is there one, like, is there one that you always go back to and you go, that's just the best cast recording? Or, like, is there one that you always reference or think about as your favorite?
The one that I've done or just one in general?
Could be either. The one that stands out to you the most. It's a big question. Maybe, like, top two or three.
Well, it's hard because it's like when I grew up, so you're talking about my influences, and they may not be, you know, I wasn't necessarily listening to quality. You know what I mean? It was more about, for me, because I was an actor and because it's like what it meant to me inside. And, you know, and I would sing, you know, there wasn't YouTube when I was growing up. So I would watch forever, you know, and listen to Pippin forever. West Side Story for me was, you know, life changing. Fiddler on the Roof was life changing, you know, back in the day. So I, but, and, you know, I grew up in St. Louis, and so I had the cast albums of my parents, but I also had the Muni theater, which was a place that I would go every Tuesday in the summertime to see musicals. And so those were in Chorus Line. I think Chorus Line and Hair were shows that, you know, as a child, as a kid growing up, were my, and then in college, I remember being obsessed with Falsettos and Falsettoland and Little Shop of Horrors and, you know, and those kinds of shows. You know, but it was also, it was always me as like an actor, like wanting to like be in these things, you know what I mean? And the director with me wanting to direct them and that kind of thing. And then as far as like albums that I'm most proud of for, you know, it's really hard to choose your favorite baby. But you know, it's more about the working relationships I have with the writers. And, you know, I love working with Michael John Lacusa. I think he's a genius, you know, composer who, has not had his necessarily his, you know, day in the, I mean, he's won Tonys. I love working with Jason Robert Brown. I loved working with Michael Friedman. And obviously In the Heights was a highlight, of, you know, I mean, just to be in that room where it happened, so to speak, was an amazing, amazing experience. Yeah. And Book of Mormon was, you know, same thing, you know, in that way was a fun one to do as well.
Just iconic. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Kurt, thank you so much for taking the time. This was so fun.
Sure.
I appreciate sure. it.
No now, problem.
My favorite album of all time in rock and roll is The Wall, Pink Floyd, which I don't believe has ever been mounted on Broadway. And I feel like
tried.
Has it been? I feel like it would be hard to do, but I'm dying to see it on Broadway.
Yeah, I think that would be a great one. I would love to see it on Broadway too. I don't know how you do it. I mean, I'm sure anybody. It's just about getting the band to say okay, you know. And they've tried. I think that there's been a lot of people who have made an attempt to try to make it from the to do it.
I want
to. They did. Built. They did American Idiot. They can do that. Why not?
Or they can say, you got American Idiot. Like, what more do you want? Like, you're too greedy. Now you want The Wall also.
No, they should do it. I mean, they should do The Wall. There's no reason why they shouldn't. It would be amazing. You want to see a wall built?
Well, because in the live show, they build the wall. Yeah. I want to see a wall built in a Broadway theater and then knocked down to the audience. I think it would be iconic.
That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome. Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to see that too. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, you have your brother produce it.
I know. I've got to get him on it. Yeah. Maybe we'll come up on it together.
Exactly.
We might awesome. Win a Tony, but we won't make any money. That'll be the takeaway.
I think that'll make money. That would make money. All right, great.
Stay well out there.
Thank you. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Talk to you soon. There you have it, episode 59. Great talking with Kurt. Kurt, thanks for taking the time to come on to the show. And thanks to everyone who's tuning in right now for listening to the show. Really appreciate all of you. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at NashvilleBriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye.